But first, we'll go to Martin Summers. Martin, this 100 years since the Balfour Declaration is all winding up in the UK, but we mentioned that briefly just before the news. What do you make of it all? Because this is... I look upon Britain, actually, as spawning these poison children around the world. The United States has become one of the biggest threats to world peace ever, with its massive nuclear arsenal and these enormous invasions that have been going on since 2001, the War on Terror, and Israel too, both created by the Brits.
Yes, and of course you could argue the similar things in Sri Lanka and elsewhere around the world. I think it's rather strange that the British government thinks it's okay to celebrate the Balfour Declaration rather than recognising that it's been a rather poison chalice for the Palestinians. They should have been saying, yes, we're glad we helped set up the State of Israel, but we're still not happy with the situation. They should have invited Palestinian representatives to meet them as well.
Why haven't they?
Because they're in the pocket of the Zionists, and we're aligned with the United States, who is about to go to war with Iran for their benefit, and we're going to go too. That's what the signal is. And I don't think most people in this country are, in fact, super pro-Israel, but the government is, and we're going to go to war with Iran to help them out, and people out there should realise that that's what we're signing up to do.
So why did Britain sign the Balfour Declaration 100 years ago?
Well, I've just been reading an awful lot about this. They signed it because there was a view in the British War Cabinet that the Jewish lobby was particularly powerful and could get the Americans into the war on the side of the British. And at the same time, they were promising Sharif Hussein of Mecca that there was going to be an Arab state in the Middle East, which would include Palestine. So they were actually saying, you know, they were speaking through both sides of their mouth at once, partly because there was no communication between people like Lawrence of Arabia and Mark Sykes, who was working with the French to talk to the Israelis. Well, they weren't Israelis then. They were just the Jewish lobby, if you like. And... yeah, but under those circumstances, promises were made which probably shouldn't have been made, frankly. And we're still living with the consequences in the Middle East today.
Now, some say that the British signed it because it was an agreement by the Zionists in the United States to bring the US into World War One.
That's what I just said, Tony.
Yes, I know, but, okay, but you actually agree with that? What's the evidence?
I think the evidence is pretty weak. In actual fact, that Chaim Herzog and the Zionists were very influential, but they really couldn't pull that kind of stuff off. It was an illusion that British politicians had, because they were quite anti-Semitic. They saw the Jewish kind of banker conspiracy thing as being terribly important, and of course the Zionists, you know, played on that perception.
So it was just
that they did have the power to do it.
So it was coincidence then that the
Americans... Well, it wasn't coincidence. Obviously,
I mean, there was a peace treaty offered by the Germans, and they were saying, "Well, let's finish this war."
Well, indeed, and there's evidence that the Zionist lobby, such as it was in the US at that time, was in favour of going to war for Britain. And of course you had Zionist militias and so on, etc. They saw this as an opportunity. But I think the idea that they were powerful enough at that stage to dominate US policy is simply wrong. You know, I think that was just an exaggeration. But of course, today, the Zionist lobby, Sheldon Adelson, for example, is a dominant figure in US politics. There's no doubt about it.
Well, we're also joined by journalist and writer Kevin Carhill. Hi, Kevin.
Hiya.
What do you make of the whole Balfour business?
I think Balfour, there's substance in what both of you have both said, but I think Balfour had no idea. This is a case of somebody recklessly, carelessly and stupidly signing for something, the consequences of which he didn't neither thought about nor worked out. He would have...
Somebody else surely had, though.
Well, the people who might have, you know, said don't do that would be the Foreign Office. People like Lawrence of Arabia, who were not on the side of the Zionists. And it's amazing they didn't put a bigger oar in. But I think there's a terrible... Reading the document, I think Balfour did not know what he was doing.
Well, I think most people would say he knew exactly what he was doing, that he was there to create this religious state in the Middle East, rather like Cromwell created the plantations in Northern Ireland.
I've just been writing about those. That's a sensitive point. But no, I still... You know, here's a statesman doing something he thought was at best, in Britain's interest, but with no thought for the consequences.
You know. So they did say at one stage that they wanted to have a little Ulster in Israel, as a, because the thinking at the time was the Suez Canal is the key. Yeah. It's the key part of the British Empire, and we've got to protect it. So if we've got a buffer state there with a compliant population, that's if there was any geopolitical thinking behind it, that was what it was. But you've got to remember that people like Lloyd George, for example, were brought up in very religious families in North Wales. And as Lloyd George himself said, of all these places, I knew more about them than I knew about my own country. And there was a huge kind of... Just as there was a sort of romantic sympathy for the Arabs in the Lawrence of Arabia circles, yeah, you've got a similar romantic, delusionary sympathy for, you know, why shouldn't the Jews go all go back to Palestine?
The Lawrence of Arabia was just the part of wooing the Arabs, so while others were wooing the Jews.
That's right.
The idea being to create two sides which are both controlled.
Well, what they wanted was to...
By the colonial powers.
Yeah, well, they are playing their usual divide-and-rule games, and we're still living with the consequences, aren't we?
I'm not trying to excuse Balfour Tony, far from it, but I think sometimes people like him just do something unutterably stupid. And the trouble is, nobody has foresight. Nobody could have foreseen, I think, the state of Israel, the nuclear-armed state of Israel.
I mean, this is what the Zionist lobby had been campaigning for a long, very long time. So, I mean, it wasn't as if it was just a little error, a little mistake on a piece of paper, surely.
Well, yeah. No,
I was going to say, but the conception of it was originally was that there would be there was already a Jewish community there, which was largely integrated, and that some others would come, but that the state of Israel would just be a kind of virtual state, really, that most Jews around the world would know about it, and it would be great that they'd got a state, but that it wouldn't be very powerful, and it wouldn't have a lot of, you know, they weren't certainly envisaging mass emigration there. The Zionists were, but of course they were a tiny minority. I mean, Jews around the world regarded them as rather eccentric Rastafarians, you know. We live in New York, we're not going to Jerusalem. They haven't even got proper toilets, you know. That was the general view, and nobody could have foreseen what eventually was going to happen when you had a huge influx of people, particularly at the end of World War II.
Well, you say that, but they could foresee it, because this is what the Zionist lobby had been pushing for decades.
Well, you can see it from the Palestinian Arabic point of view. Like, you can't promise our country to somebody else, because it's just not yours to promise.
Okay, let's just move on to look at the cyber attack on the National Health Service. This has just been in the news today, Kevin. Apparently now it's being blamed on North Korea. Now, I wonder, is that credible?
What was this, there?
The NHS cyber attack. I think it was back in May, which was a whole bunch of ransomware, what they call money that was supposed to be paid through Bitcoin.
Yeah, I knew about the attack. The way the intelligence services, particularly the Western ones, are flinging blame around, it's impossible to know. It's possible, it might even be likely, but why would they pick on the NHS? We're miles away from America. Why didn't they pick on an American health system, which is probably is far less well protected? It's just most of the Western commentary on the situation now is, wait for this, you'll hate me, false news. People like Con Coughlin in The Telegraph write all about the horrible things the Russians are supposed to be doing. He never writes about what we're doing to the Russians.
What are we doing to them?
We are interfering in their elections. We are sending in hostile propaganda from Radio Free Europe and all those daft propaganda stations.
Radio Liberty, is that still going?
Yeah, put that on the. But you know, you get this in completely one-sided account, which is misleads the British public. The British public are able to make their own minds up. But when you get persistent lying by 5, 6 GCHQ and everybody, it's terrible.
So are you saying that Home Office Minister Ben Wallace, who's today saying the government believed, I quote, quite strongly, close quote, a foreign state was behind the ransomware attack and named North Korea? Now, The evidence supposedly, and maybe you could just tell us whether you think this is evidence, is that the Home Office security experts, I'm not sure if they actually work for the Home Office or they've farmed that job out to a private company, I'm not sure, that part of the WannaCry code was the same as that found in Whiteout, NestEgg and MacTruck malware, which originated from North Korea. So there we are. I don't know if you... Is that good enough evidence to say that's where it came from?
No, it isn't. And coming from the Home Office, the fathers of lies. You know, that place is totally corrupt. They're saying these things, but you asked, as a number of the peers have recently asked, you asked the Home Office about PRISM, the spying on us. And they lie and they prevaricate and, you know, don't answer. I think it's just more speculative nonsense being pumped out by people who don't know what they're talking about.
Well, you can say that, but Ben Reed, analyst at cybersecurity and malware protection specialist FireEye, maybe he's something to do with this government inquiry, who knows, said the shared code likely means that at a minimum WannaCry operators share software development resources with North Korean espionage operators.
I mean, it's possible that North Koreans are hostile to everybody in the West. And if they found a gizmo that makes life difficult for us, that's quite possible. But the evidence shown up, the evidence offered so far is ludicrous.
Well, the other thing, Tony, from the evidence point of view, is that we have evidence that the Western intelligence services have developed cyberware that allows them to make a cyber attack look as if it comes from somebody else. That's one of the things that's come out. And frankly, you've got to ask what credibility any of these people have got. And we're being softened up for a potential war with North Korea. I mentioned war with Iran earlier, but it looks like North Korea is further down the line to being attacked. And it's worrying that they're saying stuff like this for exactly that reason.
As I say, not only do we have the evidence of PRISM, you know, absolute... We have two judgments on it, by the highest court.
Just remind us what PRISM is.
PRISM is the American mass surveillance program running in the United Kingdom. It's criminal and it's unlawful. That's what the judge said. Those are not my opinions. And you ask any of these experts in the Home Office, as I've been doing for 3 years, as a number of MPs and peers have been doing, they'll tell you it isn't happening and they'll do nothing about it. And then they tell you, ooh, they've detected, you know, North Korea. Don't believe, till they tell the truth about PRISM and the mass surveillance, don't believe a word they say. That would be my opinion anyway.
I think that's pretty correct. The ordinary population, they need to recognise that Western governments routinely lie about these kind of things. The Stuxnet virus, for example, which was used to attack the Iranians, was malware created by the Israelis and the Americans, deliberately targeted at Iranian nuclear facilities. It leaked into the cyberspace and then caused all kinds of other problems, particularly at Fukushima. I think most serious people think that was pretty clear that that was them. The Israelis have virtually said, yes, we did it, ha ha, aren't we brilliant? It's totally illegal. And if you go around attacking other people's stuff with malware, and of course they were suggesting that they should do the same thing with the underground in Moscow. You know, why don't we mess around with... And you can imagine the Russians are getting... So you're suggesting that you should be allowed to attack our underground because we're supposedly, engaged in cyber warfare with you. This is an escalation of rhetoric as well as a kind of escalation of interference.
One of the excuses given for this black propaganda by, if you like, the Western side, is that Russia annexed the Crimea. Well, I'm the author of Who Owns the World, and the Crimea belonged to Russia, historically. It was grabbed about the same time we grabbed Gibraltar, but it was historically Russian.
Well, it was placed in the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic by Khrushchev, who was Ukrainian, after a drinking bout, I understand.
And that
was all part of, you know, trying to manipulate the votes inside the Soviet Communist Party back in the 50s. But the population are overwhelmingly Russian-speaking.
Yeah.
And they have been since Catherine the Great annexed it in the 1780s.
The use by the Western propaganda machine of the Crimea is pure pretext. And another thing, the revolution in the Ukraine was provoked by money from the West. And now everybody forgets that. Oh, weren't us.
Well, the democratically elected government were forced out at gunpoint, yep. and we supported it.
Yep.
And, of course, if you do that, you've then escalated the political situation to civil war level.
Well,
which is why you're supposed to accept election results and wait for the next chance to vote.
Well, tell that to the Kenyans.
Well, isn't that interesting what's happened in Kenya?
Yeah, because, I mean, it's interesting that this is part of the one of those non-integrated gap countries, I seem to remember, that the AFRICOM is about destabilising. That's the whole point of what AFRICOM's doing in that part of the world.
I haven't followed it closely, Tony. I mean, I know, obviously, I know quite a bit about the history of Kenya.
There's been a lot of violence today.
I say no, but I mean, the opposition refused to go with the rerun, even though they'd lost the previous election, and the courts had said, no, the election wasn't fair, we're going to have a rerun, but then the opposition decided not to go with that rerun and boycotted the poll, which is, I think, worrying, because this is the way in which civil wars can happen if there isn't enough consensus about how to run elections, etc. And, you know, it's a dangerous situation.
In the background to the cyber stuff, Kevin, also we've heard last week, this was in USA Today, what I thought was an excellent op-ed by one of their writers, Ev Elrich, who's an opinion piece contributor, saying that serious legislation is required to combat the countless abuses of power by the Web Trust. The headline is, "Break up the Google, Facebook, Amazon web monopoly. Policymakers are beginning a long overdue reappraisal of the giant website and social media companies that dominate the internet today, or as they might have well have been called a century ago, the Web Trust. Facebook spreads lies for money, grossly distorting our elections. Google has been hit with a whopping $2.7 billion fine in Europe for biasing its search results towards pay-for-play favourites. Amazon's acquisition of Whole Foods suggests its stranglehold on online shopping is targeting the bricks-and-mortar world. And consumers are starting to understand how relentlessly they are tracked and their identities probed by the Web Trust's omnipresent advertising machine. Even the edge companies, that's what he's calling them, usual boosters, are asking if they should have non-discrimination obligations consistent with our traditional concepts of common carriage, the strictest form of regulation we've seen in this sector." So he's really taking a pretty strong view that this is what we're dealing here is we need to be implementing antitrust laws, a bit like we're against big companies like Rockefeller Standard Oil back in the last century.
It's very similar. But this is very important. Without any danger of invoking your libel insurance, I can describe Microsoft, Google and Facebook as criminal corporations. That's how the Irish High Court described them in June 2014. They each engage in criminal acts here in the UK before they ever get to abuse of commercial power or anything. They're criminal corporations. They're here intercepting emails and stealing data. One is criminal, the other is unlawful. And you will not get a liable writ for that.
Our society goes on, has always protected itself from monopolists, be they utilities, railroads, oil companies, financiers, acting against abuses whilst preserving innovation and economic growth. Most of those early monopolies followed the same pattern as the Web Trust. After an initial burst of competitive activity, the landscape quickly became dominated by a handful of monopolistic giants. Now, one really good example, which hardly gets talked about, is the Microsoft-Google lawsuits, which were all dropped at the beginning of last year. So what happens is the lawyers at Google and the lawyers at Microsoft sit down together and they all agree. They say, okay, well, we'll drop our lawsuits against you if you drop the ones against us. And suddenly they're effectively a cartel.
No, that's at another level. I'm, as you know, able to correspond with the National Security Agency, and they are attempting to deal with the fact that Google, Microsoft, Facebook, and six others, have all got 10 years of criminal activity in the UK to account for. Better still, there are two laws involved. One is DRIPA and the other is the Data Protection Act. Both
Just to explain those two laws a bit better. Yeah. The Data Protection Act, we know. What's the other one?
The DRIPA is the law about interception of communications. And there's a paragraph in that which states absolutely categorically that if you intercept communications, public or private, without a warrant, it's a criminal offence. The best thing about the legislation is it provides for compensation if somebody does that to you. Now, Google and Microsoft are out of the reach of, you know, institutions like the commission and things. They're not out of the reach of you and me, who have been criminally affected. So,
Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been following this story because of Kevin's interest in it, and I think that the general point about the monopoly power these companies have is one that's understood across the spectrum in the United States. I think it's more sinister is that they've actually got a very close relationship with the secret state. And, for example, Google have demonetized Luke Radowski, who's based in New York. He's very popular. He's got lots of people been following his stuff for years. He tends to doorstep, miscreants and give them a hard time. That's why people like his stuff. But he can't make any money because Google have decided that he's fake news and he's got to go. And it's arbitrary.
He's not advertiser friendly.
Well, in other words, they're using advertising as a... I mean, if he's getting the hits, he's advertiser-friendly, isn't he?
This is exactly what goes on, actually, in many of the corporate media. And you know all about this, Kevin, actually, as well, because what happens is the advertisers say, well, we don't quite like your programmes, and so we're going to pull all our advertising unless you pull that programme.
Yeah, no, this is, but as I say, ordinary folk in the street, monopoly is a word they don't immediately connect with. If you tell them, because a judge has said it, that these companies are committing criminal offences in their houses, on their PCs and on their mobiles, then they might take a bit of notice. But that's what the judge said. And yeah. So I think the secret state and its pals in the media, and boy, it has plenty of them, are putting up big words, big issues to keep everything away from the pertinent issue, which is stealing in your house.
Now, we've lived for a long time, really, certainly since the September 11th attacks, corporate media, which is very propagandistic. They've lost a lot of the balance. For example, they don't have both points of view. They go into a program with, we're only interested in this one point of view. And there's not a kind of spread of opinion, as we try and do here. I mean, for example, reading out the comments from the people about the North Korean, the potential that this was from North Korea. We have trying to have both sides of the argument here. And what they've done over the years, particularly with Newsnight now, is, I think, a pretty appalling program, because they just simply don't have the normal countervailing point of view. Let's just use one example from this week's news, which was the imposition of this new tax by this so-called Labour mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, saying that he's going to be charging people £10 extra if they've got an old diesel car. Well, of course, this is a regressive tax. People don't vote Labour to bring in regressive taxes, taxes on poor people, taxes on people that can't afford brand new cars, and particularly brand new diesel cars with these super filters and this kind of thing. But I didn't see that anywhere in the mainstream BBC coverage. I think it was Monday or Tuesday this week at all. So we've got that from the mainstream media, which is basically it's becoming a kind of government stroke corporate announcement machine, you know, actually, which is ahead of Parliament in a lot of ways. We're going to announce this to the people on the media, and then everyone else is just going to follow along, except maybe the Daily Mail, because the Daily Mail might do it, and then the BBC might have to react to that, you know. So the media is kind of leading opinion rather than reflecting opinion, and now that sort of thing is happening too with the internet, with social media sites, Facebook beginning to block certain types of commentary, particularly with what Martin was saying about demonetization of Google. And other ways of skewing the searches so that, for example, you'll get 15% increase in if the candidate pays Google, then they can make sure that when people are searching for that candidate, they get lots of lovely articles about how wonderful they are.
No, I see this every day, and I see it particularly in this. You would think that the media would be very anxious to explain to ordinary people that, you know, they have a thief in their home. But go back to your point about the tax on the old cars. The BBC's commentary on that was laudatory. far from saying this is going to affect a lot of elderly people and poor people because their cars are older, it was all great stuff because it's greener. The BBC has an ideology and an angle. And the BBC also has failed to pick up this other issue, the criminal issue.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's... I mean, what happens is, don't forget that private media, like the stuff owned by Murdoch or the Barclay Brothers or whatever, they're under no obligation to give both sides of the argument. You're supposed to get both sides of the argument from getting somebody else's view. But when you've got public bodies like the BBC, they are actually obliged by the charter to give two sides of the argument. And as you said, Tony, perhaps they're not. And you could bring in Ofcom regulating everything, but I think that would end the headlines that we see every day from the Tory press.
Ofcom don't really act, do they? I mean, well, they've acted to close down Press TV, the Iranian channel, which is the only channel which I'm on from time to time, putting the opposite point of view.
Well, they're now talking, of course, about banning RT in the United States and so on. Now, the fact is, you've either got to allow everybody to speak, or you've got to say, right, well, anybody can say what they like, or you've got to say, right, well, we're going to have some kind of balance here, then. Now, I'm perfectly happy for the Tory press to carry on spewing out bile every day, but that means that when we say something, that's got to be reported as well, and that BBC have got to report it. Of course, what's really going on is manipulation of all the power to control narrative, which all of these corporates and governments have got, and, of course, they're often on the same side. They've got the same agenda. And that's why we have this independent, community-based radio show, because that's where you're going to hear things that you ain't going to hear anywhere else, isn't it?
Quebec, Facebook banned RT today.
Yeah.
Over this, you know...
It's Twitter, or other.
But I think Facebook have imposed something on them, or whatever.
They're not even allowed to pay to put stuff on it.
Yeah, but...
Okay, so this is to do with advertising. They're saying that... When they want to promote something, they're not going to be allowed to do that. Is that right?
Yeah.
I'll just check that. That's pretty
yeah,
worrying.
Yeah, I mean, there's something... What's going on at the moment? I was on RT earlier this week, and I was saying there's a general attack going on using the social media platforms against views they don't like. There's a purge in process.
Yep.
That's what's going on at the moment.
Okay, so we're talking about Twitter banning Russia Today and Sputnik from advertising on its services. That's what's happened yesterday. So that effectively is the Russian state media.
Well, but the point is they were paying...
Radio and television.
Yeah, well, they were paying to use Twitter as a platform to get their stuff out there, and they're not allowed to do that anymore. Of course, Twitter has only just made a profit. It's never made any profit. So there is some question about what's going to happen with these big companies in the end, because if people vote with their feet, then they might end up not being there at all.
This is fairly interesting, isn't it? The idea that a state broadcaster is not allowed to advertise. That, I mean, this is almost at the thin end of the wedge.
Well, if you see the whole picture, which I tend to do because of this issue, the Western media are now 90% failing to give any other point of view, and they are certainly failing to tell the British public about the attacks the Americans and ourselves, and no doubt others, are making on Russia. If the public knew that we were, you know, in the trenches firing at Russia, they would know why Russia might be firing back.
That's right. I think
it's really simple.
Yeah, I mean, I think the opinion polls, particularly in the US, are rather worrying, is that because people have started to believe all this relentless propaganda. I mean, people like us who are unpicking the news daily, for us it's pretty obvious that this is laughably one-sided. But for people who are busy, haven't got a lot of time, they hear that the Russians have hacked the election. There's not been a shred of evidence, frankly. Not a shred of evidence.
What's your opinion on that, Kevin?
No, there hasn't been, within the industry, which I, you know, am quite close to, there has been no credible evidence produced by either the Americans or ourselves that it was Russia.
Well, but anybody was doing anything.
It could be any... It's a pity to have to say it this way. It's inconclusive, and the stuff that's been offered up is garbage.
Well, the National Endowment for Democracy is funded by the US taxpayer, and it intervenes in elections all the time, all over the world. They get huge checkbooks.
Especially Russia.
The Russian election coming up in March, they are going to be spending millions to try and get their people elected. Yep. They won't succeed because they haven't got any popularity. Yep. But on the other hand, our taxes are going to be spent on that.
Yep. But any ordinary person in the street in Britain will understand if we shoot at the Russians, they'll shoot back.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, they were talking about why don't we carry out cyber attacks on the Moscow Underground.
But
can you imagine if the Russians were saying we're going to carry out cyber attacks on the London Underground, we'd be going mental. Okay. But we're allowed to say that,
Kevin,
and then the Russians
Can you give us an idea of where these cyber attacks we are doing are occurring and what evidence you've got for that?
The evidence offered by the Western security services is very, very poor. It is not decisive. What's missing is, given all the security companies and agencies and everything else, what's missing is something credible, and it's not that difficult to find it. If somebody does an attack, it may take time, but you can go all the way back to their domain name and everything. And with supercomputers, you can unravel thousands of links in minutes.
That's obvious, isn't it? I mean, if they had anything, we'd have seen it. But, of course, what's happened is they've created this illusion. What they've shown is just by repeating and repeating and repeating the same nonsense, eventually it does have an impact on people's capacity to make independent judgments about what they're hearing. And that's why they do it, I suppose, because it works.
Tony, on your desk is an email from the former White House privacy advisor to Barack Obama. He didn't know that intercepting communications in Britain is a criminal offence. It's in his email. I mean, he thought it was okay because it was only a civil offence. Now, this is the level of absurdity we're dealing with. And the person who authorised the criminal activity in Britain during the Obama era was Obama. David Cameron asked Obama to lay off and stop it, and Obama refused. And there's Obama's advisor saying, oh, gee, chaps, I didn't know it was a criminal offence.
Well, I mean, surely what that's doing is it's just telling us that the law enforcement is not working and there is no real justice. You can't really expect justice. I suppose, actually, it's exactly the same as people in Catalonia are thinking right now.
Keep driving at it. Every day in the United Kingdom, 38 million people have their emails criminally intercepted by companies we've mentioned earlier, Microsoft, Google, Facebook. And the person who insisted that go on after it became public the Americans were doing this was President Obama, nice President Obama.
I think what's interesting about this is that because you say it was a civil offence, they felt that that's not serious, it's not a criminal offence. But of course, this is the Achilles heel of this whole thing, because these are actually commercial organisations, and the way the civil law works is people have got to take them to court and get a civil suit against them, which of course could potentially bankrupt them if a bandwagon effect was created. I think let's hope that might be one way of bringing these people down to size.
But when I was doing my column for RT before the Russian intervention in Syria, and RT sort of swiveled their eye from me to you, Martin. I did a piece about a class action that was being taken against Google, and this was by a whole bunch of about 30 people over in the US who decided to get together and say, well, hang on a minute, guys, we're all having our personal private data, which is being written in our emails. Say, for example, I don't know, maybe we've got an interest in a certain type of car, or anything that's in the email was being used by Google to target advertising to them. And they said that they believed that that was illegal, and that they wanted compensation for their rights being... In fact, I'm not even sure if it was a criminal or a civil matter, but the fact was that the judges in the US ruled that, no, you can't have a class action to do that. What you've got to do is you've got to have lots of individual actions, which, of course, Google picked people off one by one. Now, the interesting part of this was an email I sent over to To their editor who was in Moscow, who was using a Gmail account, right? So for whatever reason, they decided that the Gmail accounts could communicate with other Gmail accounts. So the RT staff in Moscow had gone over to using Gmail, not their office accounts. And I sent this email to her, I think it was late on a Thursday night, early Friday morning, with this article. The article still hadn't appeared by Monday, and I phoned them up and said, well, what's happened to the article? You didn't like it? And she said, what article? Mm. So what's happened is Google have just deleted an email that I've sent as a journalist to an editor, which is critical of them. And I think it's important to understand how this kind of thing works. What this tells me is that the judicial system is part of the problem now, that they're not going to be making decisions on the behalf of ordinary people when it comes to these tech giants, who it seems to me are absolutely in bed with the National Security Agency and GCHQ.
To reinforce the point you're making, do you remember when I got the High Court order against the police forces and the information commissioner, ordering them, or inviting them to investigate? One of the police forces, you've actually got the letter, yes, has crawled out of bed after nearly 2 years. But the information commissioner is the big problem. She's paid more than 120,000 a year, and she's got a budget of 21 million to stop your emails being thieved and mine. And the thievery is criminal. Police job. Her job is to stop the, and to get us our compensation for this. Funny enough, we don't have to worry about ups and downs in American law. Over here, the situation is utterly cut and dried, and the two judgments are in. In other words, we don't have to start a case. The Irish High Court judge, Gerard Hogan, found categorically. The European Court of Justice endorsed his judgment and cut off all emails to America. They didn't stop, of course, but the judges tend to quite truly read it right from our point of view. And it's the regulators who are paid all the money by us, the taxpayer, who support the American authorities in this criminal activity and protect Microsoft, Google, Facebook and the other six.
Martin, what we're dealing with, I suppose, here is a sort of massive oligopoly of these massive companies. People have been persuaded to sort of go along with things like Facebook because it's kind of cuddly and friendly, but it now looks as if this is being used against the users in a way, you know, so that if there are particular types of views, they will be censored now. What does this indicate about the bigger geostrategic process going on?
Well, if you think about it, the internet was developed as a military infrastructure in the first place.
It was a way of communicating which could resist a nuclear attack. Yeah. So that the idea was that it was a complete network, and if you could take out any part of that network, and any kind of information would then route round the damaged parts of the network.
That's right. So, but in other words, there was huge amounts of public money committed to it in the first place. So it wasn't a creation of like James Watt inventing stuff in his back garden or something. So, but what's actually happened is these big companies have become private sector monopolists, but they're beholden to the government, A, for their very existence, and B, to protect them against competition and so on. And it's a symbiotic relationship, and it's becoming very clear now that they are being used as political censors. And it's not just commercial. They've got commercial interests, but they're also
used by governments. Are they being used by elected people, or are they being used by interest groups?
No, check it up. The question all this poses, our country is the victim every day of 38 million criminal acts. The government knows. Theresa May was told in June or July 2013 that this was happening and it was criminal and unlawful. She was told that by Malcolm Rifkind. David Cameron went on the attack and asked Obama to stop it. And Obama refused. Now, what does that say about the relationship with the United States? And what does that say about the ability of the government to impose the rule of law? It raises a completely different question. It raises a question about how and why our government is engaging in criminal activity with a party from abroad.
But it's never going to find itself guilty, the government, is it? Just like in Madrid.
No, but the European courts have twice handed in their verdicts. And the other letter, that unusual letter from the president of the European Court of Justice, it takes 18 months to get a case into his court. He wrote to me after 2 weeks, return of post, because the decisions, the two courts, the judgments of the two courts in relation to the American spying was that it's unlawful and criminal. And the European Court ordered communications with the United States closed down. And one of the reasons the court ordered the halting of all data transfers to the United States was the judges in the European Court realised they were being spied on too.
Martin.
Well, I mean, obviously I haven't got the close, detailed knowledge of these court cases that Kevin's got, but I think it's pretty clear to people out there that these companies are abusing their power and they're in bed with the deep state. And of course we've got a straightforward answer to that is don't use them, don't buy their stuff. We had our former mayor on before and he was saying that
George Bergson,
yeah, and he was saying not to use, to use what consumer power we've got. Now I think what really does worry them, yeah, well, we have to sue as well. I agree.
Okay, let me just present one problem here, and that is that once people have got an email address, it's actually quite problematic to change. Because everyone's got your email address. If it happens to be a Gmail, well, shame on you. That's very you can actually, for around about £100 a year, buy a email address. And maybe this is something that we should be thinking about having to... I mean, I know people just don't have the money to do it. But there is a disadvantage, isn't there, in actually having to go for something that's free like that. Kevin?
Tony, can we... Why do we... We have been betrayed by the government we elected and pay to protect us. We haven't been protected. They've colluded with the criminals. What we can do and what the companies can do nothing about is we can sue. And I'm working on that right now.
Well, if we can get that running around on the internet as a meme, you can sue, you can get, it's like PPI, you can get X amount of money out of these companies.
Yeah, but look what happened, that case with Google in the United States. They couldn't do the class action and they were all taken to court separately by Google. I don't know if they were given little payoffs out of court or whatever, but that was the way they deal with these things.
Well, I'm in consultation with one QC and a firm of solicitors. The law has been stated. In other words, these companies are already convicted. One of the worst steps in trying to bring a case is proving your case. You don't have to do that. The judgment is in. But the people who should have activated the judgment, the government, have run for it. Now, why have they done that? Why have they abandoned their people? What is the hold the United States has on this place?
Well, if they're bugging everybody's emails and so on, then they'll probably know everything about everybody, and that's why I think they can have their legs broken or their careers destroyed or whatever, can't they?
Let's escalate this a step. We've only spoken mostly about the danger and the injury that has been caused to ordinary people in their houses. The surveillance system used by the Americans was never differentiated. They are spying on British government, which is a breach of the Official Secrets Act.
Well, I think one of the things that's made the Germans very angry is the fact that they're carrying out lots of industrial espionage, and that's clearly that's clearly been going on. So it's a can of worms, isn't it?
Okay. Well, Tuesday this week, for the good news, we have from the Guardian and the Press Association. UK terrorism law expert is warning the government over plans for new legislation. Max Hill has questioned the Home Secretary's plan to impose a 15-year jail term on people who repeatedly view terrorist content online. Introducing new laws to prosecute extremists would be wrong, the Independent Reviewer of Terrorism Legislation said. Terrorists who commit modest or middle-ranking offences should not face long jail terms, Max Hill suggested. In a speech in central London, he warned against a knee-jerk reaction to the wave of terror attacks before the general election, as he raised concerns about government plans for new laws. He questioned proposals announced by Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary, we only got in by about 3 votes, by the way, to impose jail terms of up to 15 years on people who repeatedly view terrorist content online. Hill said a very careful work would be required to stop innocent people being caught up in the offence. Theresa May declared enough is enough as England was left reeling from those terrorist attacks and vowed to crack down on extremism. Hill said, thought without action must not be criminalised. While we can all agree that there should be nowhere for real terrorists to hide, we should also agree legislating in the name of terrorism when the targeted activity is not actually terrorism would be quite wrong. Now, this is very Orwellian. You first, Kevin.
You know, I read the person, Hill's predecessor was David Anderson, and Anderson was an utter sucker. Anything the spooks asked for, Anderson agreed with. And that's why we've got the Investigatory Powers Act. He virtually wrote it. Now, Hill is much more cautious, much more lawyerly. He is inclined to say, you know, putting people away. You'll be putting college lecturers away, me dears. People who are studying terrorism with the usual ham-fistedness of the Home Office. People like that will be caught up. He is trying to make the law workable. And people who persistently view terrorist stuff and may be a danger, that can all be worked out. Imposing 15-year sentences is going back to the 17th century and hanging people because they took rabbits in a field. It's primitive law.
Yeah, I think it's that's clear that he's right and that the government are in the wrong there. Can I just make another further point, which is some terrorist propaganda online, for example, the White Helmets operating inside Syria, people should they be banned? Even though they're funded by the British government, they're embedded with Al-Qaeda and they've been producing fake news, you know, pretend chemical weapons attacks in order to encourage people to support Al-Qaeda in Syria. Should Captain Le Mesurier, based in Turkey, who helped them set up those videos, never mind watching them, they produced the videos. Shouldn't Le Mesurier be doing 15 years in prison for supporting Al-Qaeda?
Also, we mustn't forget this story this week, Martin, which you pointed out to me. The crazy killer confession may end a 30-year-old Belgian mystery. This is reported by Reuters. In Brussels, a mystery that has troubled Belgium for over 30 years may be solved after a deathbed confession by a former policeman that he was one of the crazy Brabant killers who left 28 people dead in a bizarre string of robberies in the early 1980s. Officials on Monday confirmed reports that detectives have been working on new leads for months. We're optimistic about finally identifying the group, also called the Nivelles Gang. Its bloody three-year spree long fueled conspiracy theories involving right-wing plots and official cover-ups during the era of the Cold War, with members dubbed the Giant, the Killer, a getaway driver known as the Old Man, and possibly other accomplices. The gang terrorised towns in Brabant province around Brussels, staged over a dozen raids, often on supermarkets, sometimes taking barely petty cash, but gratuitously gunning down customers, staff and even children. 28 people killed, Martin.
Yes, and of course, if you check on the films like the Gladio film made by Frankovich,
Alan Frankovich, BBC Two Time Watch film.
Yeah, you can see that the suspicion behind this is basically NATO intelligence services carrying out random attacks.
Even one of the
soldiers, why did they do that? What's the motive?
One of the soldiers in that film says, "Well, I was sent in just to clock it at the time and how people would lock up the supermarket." He wasn't actually part of the attack itself, no. But he was being run by the military.
Indeed, and what you say? Well, what's the motive? Well, the motive, as I understand it, was, if you remember, there was the whole campaign against cruise missiles going on in Europe at the time. In 1983, we nearly had a nuclear war. The Russian lieutenant colonel that didn't press the button died recently, and he said, well, I'm glad I didn't press the button, but we were really paranoid, we thought you were going to attack us. And of course they wanted to put cruise missiles into Belgium. Belgium had a socialist government at that time, and they didn't want the cruise missiles. So that's what the motive for these attacks was to create fear and loathing in Brussels, and it succeeded. And the socialist government caved in and the cruise missiles came.
What about parallels with those terror attacks that we were hearing about just then from the government's terrorism law expert, Max Hill?
Well, the point about terrorism is it's much more widespread and it's not coming from one direction.
But these attacks before the election, doesn't this suggest that they may have been organised elsewhere?
Listen, that is a suspicion, Tony, and on this show you well know we're quite prepared to go and analyse those things. People have to realise that NATO intelligence service has got a track record of carrying out terrorist attacks going back 30, 40 years. Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, has said as much.
There's a lovely line in House of Cards. There's somebody sitting beside the Prime Minister and there's a big bump, obviously a bomb. And the advisor says to the Prime Minister, one of ours or one of theirs?
Okay. Well, thanks very much. The time does fly on this programme, I must say. Time to sign off now for the news at 7, the Murdoch News, that is. Coming up is live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. That was former Bristol Mayor George Ferguson. Also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and to investigative writer who's just got a new book out, haven't you, Kevin? I think it's going to be out soon, is it?
It's slightly. We had an editor problem. The editors have left the company, so the book is...
What about Who Owns Britain? A new edition of that coming out or not?
I haven't found somebody to republish. No, the book that's coming out is Who Owns Ireland.
Okay. And that's Kevin Carhill. So the show's story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1979 and someone called Sheila. Do please join us at the Politics Show at the same time next week. Don't forget to put your clocks back on Saturday night. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.